folks, and welcome to Christ in Every Word, a podcast of the Concordia Bible Institute, housed on the beautiful campus of Concordia University, Wisconsin. This is your opportunity to read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest the sacred scriptures with me, Dr. Brian Gurman, Associate Professor of Theology here at the University and the Director of the Concordia Bible Institute. We're cruising along in our top 40 texts. What a journey it's been. Already on number 17 on the docket today, number 17 of this list of 40 is Ecclesiastes chapter 1. That's right. We've got space for Ecclesiastes. How often do you hear a sermon or Bible study on Ecclesiastes? I suppose some of our philosopher friends give it some attention for its wisdom and its apparent cynicism about the world. Meaningless, meaningless, everything is meaningless, right? I gotta be honest, it was very nearly didn't make the cut, Ecclesiastes 1. When I did this top 40, very difficult decision. I think I've remarked on this. How do you pick 40 out of the Bible? So many great texts in there. Ecclesiastes 1, I suppose I wanted my students to get a sense of the Bible's wisdom in its fullness. Proverbs, great. You know, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the righteous do a lot better than the wicked, and so on. Song of Songs, oh, that's wonderful. Isn't that neat? And so on. But Ecclesiastes, wow, what kind of wisdom is this? And so I forced them to think about that a little bit. I want you to tell me what kind of wisdom is on display here in Ecclesiastes. Vanity of vanities, everything is vanity. I wanted them to get a flavor for this part of the spectrum of the Bible's wisdom as well, and to get them to consider quite seriously what this has to do with the wider biblical narrative, especially what kind of testimony is this to the person and work of Jesus Christ. So the text in front of us here for this particular podcast is Ecclesiastes 1, verses 1 to 11, and then I throw in verse 18 as well. So not even the full chapter. Let me read that, and then we'll jump in. Lots to say about this, and maybe a little more intro is in order. But nonetheless, let me read it first, and then we'll see which way it goes from there. So Ecclesiastes 1 reads as follows. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has already been in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Alrighty, so there you have the words of Ecclesiastes chapter 1. Isn't that a fine how do you do for this podcast series? I suppose I could start with a little bit of intro. I mean, Ecclesiastes itself is kind of a strange book in relation to the other wisdom books, but I think that's a good place to start. So, for example, I mentioned earlier Proverbs. Our Jewish friends especially and earlier interpreters took a lot of stock in the placement, the arrangement of Ecclesiastes following Proverbs. Proverbs is foundational for biblical wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and so on. That's repeated in various ways. It's important, so it was argued in the past quite a bit, that Ecclesiastes followed that. Ecclesiastes, pr- the Bible's wisdom is not so simple that it's just, well, the righteous prosper and the wicked are put to shame. Look around and watch the 6 o'clock news and you'll see, this is tough. I don't see that. The Bible knows very well that there are exceptions to the way that things should generally go. Ecclesiastes is kind of like the exceptions to the rules when you go through a grammar. If you ever studied a second language, I taught Hebrew or whatever, you have this, okay, here are the rules. Here's how the verb works. Here's what wisdom is. By the way, you got to know it's a little more profound than that. And Ecclesiastes was meant to be read, so it was argued, right after Proverbs, so that you know, hey, there's more to be said here. We've built the foundation, but we've got some intricacies as we keep moving along, looking at this house of wisdom. And then Song of Songs, by the way, to finish the thought, was the most sublime wisdom offered. The relationship between God and his people, between Christ and his church, the bride and bridegroom, contemplating divine love, the love of loves, was the epitome of biblical wisdom on this score. Well, anyway, here we have another book of Solomon, Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes, the Hebrew word there for it's kohelet. Kahal is to gather or to assemble. So when you hear the words of the preacher, that's the words of Kohelet, the Hebrew title of the book, Kohelet, one who gathers or assembles. Now that alone, just the title of the book is something that this is a, what? Words of one who is in authority to speak words to those who are gathered. The words of the preacher, and that keeps going in verse 1, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. It's fascinating. We don't get Solomon's name. Well, we know who this is, son of David, king. That's Solomon. Why doesn't Ecclesiastes give his name? Well, to call Ecclesiastes, to title the book according to the office of preacher, according to the office of one who assembles and one who gathers, and then to follow it up with Son of David, King in Jerusalem, without naming Solomon, is to place an emphasis on the fact that these words coming up, they might not seem all that savory. Vanity of vanities, this is tough. What is this, some sort of modern nihilistic philosophy? No. These words are coming from one who is the preacher, one who assembles, one who gathers, Son of David, King in Jerusalem. This is top-notch authority right here. Yeah, we could say Solomon, but by doing it this way, we emphasize these words are super important. They should be paying attention to them. They're coming from someone in authority. They're coming from someone with riches, with royalty, with experience, with divine favor, with divine inspiration. At first glance, we might see this as a weird, depressing book. I remember somebody said, you know, Ecclesiastes is the most depressing book of the Bible out there. But this intro is very important, that this is wisdom par excellence all the same. The words of the preacher, the son of David, the king in Jerusalem. Top-notch wisdom is coming your way, and it starts like this. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Okay, another one of these like Hebrew word moments. Vanity, you'll get English translations that put meaningless, futility. What else do you see out there? The word there is hevel. And hevel is a mist or a breath or a vapor. Literally, it's this kind of... It's this idea of breath or wind or vapor. Ruach, maybe you've heard, is spirit. That can also mean breath. But this hevel is a mist or a vapor. It's just this, whew, that's what it is. And so the word, it's getting at this idea of something that is, it's transient, it's ungraspable. You can't retain it in the way that you'd like. It's ungraspable. It's not comprehensible in the way that you would want it to be. You can't lock it down. You can't preserve this thing if it's hevel, if it's vanity, if it's mist or vapor. You can't keep it in the way that you would like to. Everything, says the preacher, vanity of vanity, everything is ungraspable. You can't finally lock it down or retain it forever. It's going to pass like a mist or a vapor or a breath. It's whew, there it goes. And you get this language sometimes in the Psalms too. All mankind is but a mere breath. You read that kind of language, like the grass that, you know, the breath of the Lord blows on the grass, Isaiah 40, it's done. You can't preserve the things that you get the sense that should be preserved. I just read this fascinating treatment, What is Time by St. Augustine. It's really profound. It's in his Confessions, one of these remarkable texts of the Christian faith. Well, anyway, there's something about what is time? Augustine said, we all act like we know what it is, but nobody really knows what it is. He said, everybody talks like, well, there's not too much time, or boy, the time flew, or whatever. We speak of it like we know everything there is to know about it. But Augustine said, nobody knows anything about time. And he ends up describing it as a tension of conscience, some sort of time for Augustine, time. We recognize that when you have some momentous occasion, let's a wedding, birth of a child, a big old birthday, celebration, anniversary, these wonderful life moments, we recognize in that present moment something that we'd like to preserve a lot longer than we're able to. This should not, and we do this with our loved ones all the time who have died, who have gone before us. They'll have our memories. They could never take them away from me. I've got memories of grandpa on the farm and this sort of thing. They can't take those from me. I'll still have those. We do this naturally. The time has fleeted. The transience of life has moved us right along. And so we seek some sort of permanence. We want to grasp and hold on to something we sense by nature should not be transient. Death is not natural. There's something about my loved one should remain. This should not happen. Our separation, his life should endure beyond the transience of this life. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, everything that you sense should last longer than it does is ungraspable. You can't finally retain the thing. And so this is the wisdom on display. It's actually quite profound. I think Ecclesiastes gets a short shrift when it's, well, it's just depressing. That just sounds like that's all it is. It's actually quite profound, making a statement about the reality. All of creation, Paul says, all of creation is groaning because of this. It's dying. It's decaying. It's moving along. Grass, flowers, you know, and then in the breath of then it's done. There should be a new heaven and a new earth that lasts forever, right? Revelation and so on. This is the wisdom of Ecclesiastes, a recognition of the situation, that in our lives we are trying to preserve what is finally ungraspable. We can't finally retain it in the way that we inherently sense it should be. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the... Notice what happens here. I don't think this is often noticed. I think this is a lot. The word toil, for example, is repeated. This wind and these streams and this creation stuff. Notice what's happening here. This is a Genesis 2 kind of word. Made for toil. This is a creation kind... This is meaning of life stuff. Notice the first thing that Solomon goes to here is, what does man gain by all the toil? This is Genesis 2 kind of stuff, at which he toils under the sun. Finally, at the end of the day, what is gained? What's left over? The Hebrew word means like a leftover. After you work, what remains, what actually endures? So you go to work, you do what you got to do. You come home and, okay, that's great. Well, what actually endures? What lasts? I mean, you went to work and you did your thing, but even the things that you did, are those going to last forever? Whatever it is that you accomplished, you know, I'm a teacher or whatever, you know, are those going to last? For somebody builds a building, somebody, you know, health professions, heals somebody, is that health going to last forever? Is that building going to last forever? What's left over after you do what you do? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises, the sun goes down, hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south, goes around to the north, around and around goes the wind. And on its circuit the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. This is fascinating, by the way. It's kind of, I don't know. Well, this is sort of, isn't it? What wisdom is there in saying, well, people come, people go. But the earth remains forever. Sun rises, sun goes down. Right? But on the circuits, the wind goes and so on. There is, so now Solomon goes to this, there is some sort of permanence that we can sense, even in the transients. A generation goes and a generation goes and comes, right? But the earth remains forever. There is this sun rises, sun goes down. There's a cycle there. Everything's just kind of going on and on. But there is a cycle that exists. Earth remains forever. This cycle, up, down, we just take it for granted, the sun. There is this cycle that just exists. We get a sense of permanence, even in the way that creation is designed. Sun goes up, sun comes down. Sun goes up, sun comes down. On the one hand, it's transient. Hey, the sun doesn't stay up forever. It's going to go down, right? But it's not going to stay down forever. It's going to come back up, right? Things are going to change. But at the same time, that cycle, boy, you get a sense of, boy, it's just, that's how it goes. Earth remains forever. This is just how it goes. This is just how it goes. The wind goes all over the place, right? Here, there, and everywhere, verse 6. But it is on its circuits. It is, I don't know, running according to its path. There is a kind of, what, cyclical time here. There is a sense of permanence all around us, even as it's in tension with the transients. It's in the fabric of creation. It's in the fabric of our lives. And there's a profound wisdom in acknowledging this. All right. I'm going to say more about that in a minute, but we're overdue for a break, so let's do that, and then I'll be right back.
We'll be back in just a moment to the Concordia Bible Institute podcast. In the meantime, I'd like to have you consider this question. What is most important in higher education? How do you prioritize all the knowledge to be gained at an institution of higher learning? Concordia University, Wisconsin, located on the shores of Lake Michigan in Mequon, Wisconsin, just north of Milwaukee, is an institution that is committed to excellence in learning, but at the same time realizes that excellence in itself is insufficient without development in vocation. We believe that God works through our vocations, our callings, in order to serve the needs of those around us. The mission statement of Concordia University puts it this way: Concordia University, Wisconsin is a Lutheran higher education community committed to helping students develop in mind, body, and spirit for service to Christ in the church and the world. You can learn more about the over 70 programs offered at Concordia by visiting the website, www.cuw.edu. And if you're benefiting from our Christ in Every Word podcast, I encourage you to support this ministry by mentioning it to others and by offering your monetary support. Please consider supporting the Concordia Bible Institute by going to our website, www.concordiabible.org, and clicking on the contribute page. And now, back to the podcast.
Alrighty there, folks. We are back with our study of Ecclesiastes 1. Isn't this fun? This Ecclesiastes, this is another world. But again, I wanted my students to think through the kind of wisdom that is being put on display here. In what way is this helpful for understanding the nature and character of God, for understanding humanity? And in what ways does it testify to the person and work of our Savior? We left off with this idea, even in creation, you get a sense of, man, this stuff, is there permanence here? Earth remains forever, Solomon says. And then you read later, now this thing's all going to be destroyed. A new earth is going to, you know, there is this sense, verse 7, all streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. There's no final, the streams are running, they're on their course, but there's no finality there. No final answers, there's no end inside. The sea just keeps going to the place where the streams flow. There they flow again. All things are full of weariness. There's a, a kind of burden in acknowledging this reality. There is this kind of tension. I mean, I'm just fascinated by Augustine. He called time a tension of conscience. There is within humanity, we know this, there's this tension. There's this struggle of conscience to recognize that what is truly present is but a flash. It doesn't endure in the way that it should. There's a burden in every part of life when you acknowledge this. I heard this the other day, one of my colleagues talking about, well, my kid, only a few more years and they're going off to college. I can't get those years back, he said. I can't get those years back. I lost loved one or somebody, near and dear. I can't preserve this as long as I feel like I should be able to, or that this thing doesn't last in the way that it should. I know it should. It shouldn't end in this way. It should last longer. A man cannot utter it. It's hard to even, Augustine on this time business, he struggled. I don't even know what time is. It's some sort of tension of conscience. What is really present, this millisecond right now? But then, oh, it's in the past, gone. Even your best memories are going to fade and so on. It's gone. You can't finally preserve something the way that it's meant to be preserved. The future isn't here yet, so, a man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. Why is it that we're so restless? You get this with the eye all the time. Ooh, I just can't wait to see this, that, and the other. Go on trips, so I got to see the seven wonders, right? But even then, what, we want to see something else because we're never satisfied fully. What about the ear, What about this gossip? Do we ever get enough of gossip? Do we ever get enough of hearing the things that we want to hear, seeing the things that we want to... It's never satisfied. Again, I'm kind of on an Augustine kick right now. So our hearts are restless until they rest in thee. Our eyes are restless until they see God face to face. Our ears are not filled until they hear the eternal praises in the heavens. This is the sort of thing that Solomon presents before us. What has been is what will be. What has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Have you ever thought about it? You probably heard this before. Maybe it's a saying you've used. There's nothing new under the sun. In what sense is that true? Have you ever thought about that? There's nothing new under the sun. Well, we have new babies. Had another baby in the German household about a month and a half ago. There's new babies. Isn't that new? I mean, if that's not new, is there anything that's new? There's nothing new under the sun, Solomon says. So there's a new baby. Well, on the same same sin, same original sin. I mean, the same cloth of sin. There's no, that hasn't changed, right? Well, there's a new phone. I mean, this is the, right? We love what's new. This is how it works. We love what's new. There's a new phone. Oh, brand new phone. Oh, my goodness. The iPhone 34 is out. Oh, the iPhone 34. Oh, that's better than the 33. Oh, man. That's just fantastic. And you can be the first to have this brand new. You know how the appeal works. We love what's new. Why do we love what's new so much? You ever thought about that? The marketing totally prances on it because they know the human weakness of the sense of new. Why do we love what's new? Everybody loves what's new. You could be the first in the world to have this iPhone 34. It's kind of picking on, I don't mean to, it's like pick on phone day here, but iPhone 30, wow, that's fantastic. The reason we love new stuff so much is that we are duped to thinking that there is something out there that will finally do for us what we need. We recognize the transience. We're longing for something that will transcend this transience. We're longing for the eternal. We're restless for something that will finally last, something that will finally do for us what all these other things have failed to do for us. Maybe this will work. Maybe that'll work. Can we ever do a new thing, by the way? Everything gives and it takes, just to pick on the phone a little bit longer. So, the phone comes out. It'll save your life. You can be in the ditch. You can be drowning. Hey, here's the phone. It'll save your life. connect you with people across the world in a second. Hey, that's new, isn't it? Isn't that fantastic? Well, at the same time, it's going to kill your attention and kill your comprehension and your attention span and all these other wonderful things. It's going to facilitate affairs, pornography, and do all these terrible things for you. So here you have it. Everything gives and it takes. Whenever we come across something that's, oh, this is new, this is fantastic, it's going to do for us something that the world has never seen, well, it's going to take away in the same. It's going to give and it's going to take. Is there ever really an advance, a step forward? There's nothing new under the sun, Solomon said. It sounds despairing, but I think it's quite profound. Is there a thing of which it has said, see, this is new? It has already been in the ages before us. Is there anything that is truly new? Or have we just forgotten? Or is the, or if it's really new, is it really important enough to matter? I mean, this is the sort of, can we ever really do a new thing? Right? And when you see elsewhere in the Bible this language in the prophets, for example, of God, behold, I make all things new, the only one who can finally, at the end of the day, do a new thing is the one who makes a new heaven and a new earth. When we come up with a new phone or something and slap the label of newest, latest, and greatest, Solomon comes in quickly. There's a wisdom in recognizing that it is really not what it is appearing to be, what it's being presented as. It is not really and truly new. Even if it does something the world has never seen, it is not truly new because of its transience, because of its participation in that which is hevel, vanity, breath, vapor, ungraspable. It will not finally do for you what you need it to do for you. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those. Even remembrance itself, that's exactly, again, when someone, a loved one passes away, what do? We cherish the memories. Why are we doing that? We're holding on to the things that last. Well, these will last. Okay, so the life itself, the bodily life has now ceased, but these memories endure. So I'm going to latch onto those. I'm going to hold on to what is permanent in this situation. Right? That's what I have. And you know, even as time goes along, my memories of my grandfather, just to give a personal example, are fewer as I get older. I don't remember as much about him as I used to. Even those are not going to stick around in my mind. What if I start losing my own memory? Well, then what am I supposed to rely on as far as the permanence and the enduring there? There is no remembrance. There's not going to be this kind of permanence that we're longing for ultimately. And recognizing this, Solomon says, in much wisdom is much vexation. I'll bet. You ever been in that situation where I'd rather not know? The thing that's so, there's he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. I always tell it to my students, like, all right, have a good day. You know, keep learning. He who increases knowledge increases sorrow. They're at, you know, a university and they're studying and so on. What is so sorrowful about knowledge? There's a wisdom. Here's the wisdom of Ecclesiastes. I mean, this hurts, doesn't it? Doesn't it hurt to recognize the transience where there should be permanence and so on? The vexation that's involved in not, have you ever had that? I'd rather not know. I think I'd rather not know. There's some knowledge that I just can't handle, or that would hurt in some way. There's a knowledge, there's a wisdom. Here's Ecclesiastes for you. There's a wisdom in recognizing the limitations of wisdom, Solomon says. This is not just a despairing, but this is a very profound book, Ecclesiastes, and there's lots more to say, and we're going to have to wrap it up. But there's a wisdom in recognizing the limitations of wisdom. But even as we do that, there's also a wisdom in recognizing then in what ways it is that God has his wisdom for us, the wisdom of God, the wisdom incarnate. We see Ecclesiastes helps us to see more and more how this wisdom that we're thinking about here, considering the wisdom and recognizing the limitations of wisdom, is fulfilled perfectly in the apparently transient but eternal life of God's wisdom in the flesh, who came down to die and to rise. Boy, that's a transient life, right? No, he rose again. The wisdom incarnate, the wisdom of Jesus in the flesh, the wisdom of God, the wisdom of the cross, this is eternal. The person and work of God's wisdom, Jesus himself, is the eternality, is the permanence that we're longing for. All of the world's wisdom, the struggle with the wisdom and so on, is ultimately embodied in a person, God's wisdom in the flesh. In him, there is what is graspable, finally. In him, there is what is comprehensible. There is no more of this vanity of vanities. In him is the permanence that our earthly wisdom is longing for and recognizing in very limited ways. It is all in a person, God's wisdom incarnate. Fascinating stuff, and lots more to. I kind of get this. I do this with my students just to kind of whet their appetite. Look further into the book. It's fascinating how it keeps extolling this very theme. But nonetheless, we got to run. Hey, Ecclesiastes 1. Wow, fascinating stuff. Much more than just maybe a surface level despair. Quite profound for its witness to God's wisdom. That's all the time we have. Thanks for tuning in. The mission of the Concordia Bible Institute is to provide Christ-centered Bible instruction from distinguished experts who teach Christ in every word of the Old and New Testaments to strengthen faith and spread belief in the one true God. If you benefit from this podcast series, I encourage you to consider supporting the Bible Institute by going to our website, www.concordiabible.org, and clicking on our contribute page. Until next time, my friends, I'm Dr. Brian Gurman, wishing you all God's blessings in Christ Jesus our Lord.